I welcome you to Radio Enlightened Next, to our third global edition from Radio Enlightened Next. My name is Tom Steininger, and I'm very happy that we have this third English edition of our radio. Radio Enlightened Next usually is a German broadcast that we bring every week in German language, but this time we have a cooperation with Enlightened Next France. And as we have it with Enlightened Next France, this broadcast will be neither in German nor in French. It will be in English language. And I'm very happy to welcome here on the phone my friend and colleague, Carter Phipps. Carter, are you on the phone?
Hello, Carter.
Hey, Carter.
Hey, sorry, got kicked me into the wrong conference.
I see, but we have you here. Fantastic, you made it to our webcast here from Radio Enlightened Next here in Frankfurt. You're calling
hey,
in
nice
from the San Francisco Bay Area. What's the time over there?
It's 11 in the morning in the West Coast here in California.
Great, fantastic. It's great to have you in our Radio Enlightened Next show. As I just told the audience before you came in, usually we do this in German language, but this is in preparation of a conference that our friends in Paris from Enlightened Next France are holding in a couple of weeks on the October 13th, and you will be one of the speakers here in Europe in Paris. That's right, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. We're having it's quite a serious and significant conference there, and we're going to be bringing an evolutionary context and evolutionary ideas to a French audience. And, of course, the significance of that is that many of the great evolutionary philosophers, the original ones, were French, some of them, including Teilhard de Chardin and Henri Bergson and even the mother, Sri Aurobindo's partner.
Exactly.
So there's some significant French legacy there.
Yeah. And as I heard, you won't speak only to a French audience there. You will speak to a European audience, because I heard from people from the UK, people from Germany, people from Holland, and other countries coming to Paris. So it will be definitely a European event. I'm very happy that I will be there too, and I'm very happy that I will see you there in a couple of weeks.
Fantastic. Looking forward.
But of course, Carter, this is only one reason why we are happy to have you on this webcast. If I may introduce you, if this is still needed to part of the audience, you are an author, you are a journalist, and I think it's legitimate to call you leading edge in the emerging field of evolutionary spirituality, and you've worked for years as the chief editor of the Enlightened Next magazine that is known worldwide, also here in Germany, and I'm very happy that we work together on this magazine, because I did for years the German edition of the magazine. So I'm really happy to have you as a friend and a colleague here. And you just wrote a book that is really an introduction to this whole field of an evolutionary worldview, and you called this book Evolutionaries, which in itself is a very interesting word, because it's a new world, evolutionaries. And I think it's playing with the word evolution, and also with the kind of revolutionaries, as we know, as a word with a significant power and meaning behind it. So what is an evolutionary, Carter?
Well, an evolutionary is, it's a person who's really thinking about the world in a way that we've never thought about the world before. That's kind of a simple way of putting it. And it's a person who's beginning to integrate our new evolutionary understanding of both cosmology, biology, and culture, and beginning to look at that as one picture of evolutionary development. Individuals who are beginning to integrate those three domains of evolution and think about what the human experience in the 21st century means in light of that 13.7 billion year context, that 3.5 billion year context, and then the last, 35, 40, 50,000 years of the development of human civilization. We are just beginning to kind of understand this coherent picture of this evolutionary development that we've been part of, and that is integral to what it means to be human. And an evolutionary is someone who's beginning to think about that and beginning to integrate that into the way they respond to life and to culture. And so, you know, we need new words when we have new perspectives on the world, when we have a, you know, when we began to look at the world through the lens of the natural world in a new way in the 19th century, we needed a new word called a scientist to describe that.
Right.
When we began to look at the human self in the 20th century, we needed a new word, a psychologist, to describe that. And so now when we begin to integrate this temporal developmental perspective, we need a new word. And that word, at least proposed, is evolutionary.
In one of the first chapters of your book, and maybe even the very first chapter, you wrote about the evolutionaries, and you wrote how they are working in different fields of human investigation, scientists, philosophers, theologians, all kinds of stuff. But one thing is uniting them, and the way you phrased it really struck me, because you said they realized, wait a moment, we are moving. And that this we are moving is changing everything. Can you speak to that, what you mean by that?
Sure. I mean, in a way, this is like, the book itself is really spread across many different fields of study, and it has individuals, as you say, from across the spectrum, all kinds of different disciplines and fields. But, if there's any one thing that really integrates them, it's this realization at this foundational level that human life, human culture, what it means in all kinds of different fields, we're realizing that we're part of this process. We're part of this moving, we're on this moving train. And you can look at biology or cosmology or psychology or, anthropology, in so many different ways, we're realizing things we thought were static and unchanging and fixed are in fact not static and unchanging and fixed. They're actually moving. That this whole, in some ways you can even almost say that part of what we're realizing that this whole, we're not just kind of in this universe. We're not just kind of spatially part of this cosmic sea. We're caught up in this whole movement. The universe itself, in some sense, is this evolutionary expanding movement forward. And so this realization in so many different fields of study that the things we think are fixed and unchanging or not, they're part of this movement forward. And as we realize that, it changes the way we perceive the world around us, because it's so easy to kind of fall into the idea that nature is static, that human civilization is static, even the human self is static. And what we're realizing is it's not, ultimately. It's part of everything is caught up in this evolutionary process. And that's the essential insight of what it means, at least in my sense, to be an evolutionary.
Well, that's great. And you're also writing, of course, that evolution itself is an idea that is not brand new. There were European philosophers like Hegel, like Schelling, and, of course, the scientist Charles Darwin, who really had breakthrough insights in what evolution is about. And evolution, in that sense, was already a powerful idea in the last 200 years. But by reading your book, I got the sense that this is true, but there's something new evolving right now around the evolutionary worldview that's different than just a modernist perspective on this. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I certainly would. But it's good to say, as you know, Tom, because you're an expert in this, even more than I am, in the German historical roots of this. And Germany has played such a role in creating the foundations of this movement. I mean, the German philosophical tradition was critical in kind of some of the first insights in breaking this idea of stasis, in relationship to human culture and in so many ways, and it kind of helped people who followed on, like Darwin and like others, to kind of understand that and to kind of look at this, this movement and process and come up with these theories about how it works. So Germany was critical in this. But at the same time, I think what you're saying is right. In a couple different areas, we're beginning to integrate evolutionary ideas in such a way that's different than the 19th century. And because we've gone through this postmodern turn, and because we've gone through the two world wars, I hope that it's allowed us to kind of to filter out a lot of the much more naive, ethnocentric versions of what an evolutionary context means, and begin to develop a much richer understanding of what it means to be part of a moving process, and for culture and civilization itself to be moving forward, and for, you know, and also we're integrating this cosmological perspective. We didn't have this 13.7 billion year cosmological perspective, you know, in the 19th century. We didn't have these new insights, whether it's Ken Wilber or Jean Gebser or some of these deep, or developmental psychology, some of the deep insights into what it, you know, the internal, interior nature of development and how you and I develop as human beings and how we've developed the interior of consciousness and culture over the last 10,000 years. I mean, that's a big subject in and of itself, but there's a lot of insights in the book that just simply weren't available in the 19th century or early 20th century. So even though there were some great pioneers then, I really think that when you bring it all together, the picture of this evolutionary unfolding that we're beginning to describe now is fundamentally, it's much richer, it's much more expansive, it's much more profound, and there's a deeper understanding of what it means, and a more nuanced understanding.
In one chapter that you called the breaking of the spell of solidity, I think you described a kind of a modernist understanding of moving, and the picture you used is a billiard ball that is moving, and the very striking thing with the billiard ball is solid. It's a solid thing, and it's very related, of course, to a modernist, particular materialist, but also different forms of modernist thinking, that there's a solid I sense and a solid sense of a world out there, and the solidicity of all of that that allows that doesn't allow a kind of a more dynamic understanding both of subjectivity and of objectivity. And as I understand you right, also when you are bringing in that modernist thinking, modernist evolutionary thinking, or progress thinking, didn't have the whole field of interiority that we only discovered in postmodern times, evolution and an evolutionary perspective must mean something different in this new context.
That's great. That makes sense. And yes, I think that you're picking up on something there that's really true, in the sense that, yeah, you know, in a more 19th century, early 20th century sort of modernist perspective on evolution, you get this, and on movement, you do get this much more kind of sense of these material bodies kind of developing and moving through time. And it did capture a truth in that, but we've almost kind of deconstructed more deeply what it means, the nature of reality and the nature of the self and the nature of the interior world of consciousness and culture. And there's a deeper understanding of all that. And when you add that sort of depth dimension of what evolution means, I think it's you come up with a much richer understanding of how consciousness and culture evolves. And it's like you come up with a four-dimensional understanding of evolution, not a two-dimensional. And some of those earlier visions were they captured a certain spirit of what it means to recognize that we're part of this movement forward in culture, and this movement forward as part of our civilization, this movement forward. But it was kind of it could be two-dimensional. Of course, evolution is such a powerful idea. If you two-dimensionalize it, you can really abuse it in all kinds of ways, and it can serve nasty things. But nevertheless, when you four-dimensionalize it, and it has this rich interior understanding, where you start to realize, hey, you know, and you know, the core of this is this, you know, deep process that has these multiple dimensions to it. Then it's a whole different kind of experience. And I feel like sometimes when people hear the evolution, they get nervous because they think it's this two-dimensional thing, but actually we're trying to, you know, present this four-dimensional picture.
Exactly. And you were also making quite a distinction to classic Darwinian evolutionary thinking. And one point you're making here when you were talking about the selfish gene and the whole context between competition and cooperation, and you're really interpreting new scientific insights that the evolution of also nature is much more a cooperative endeavor than just an endeavor of a competition. And this in itself is also a different perspective on reality as a whole, because tell me if you don't agree with this, but I would say that the whole sense of competition as the main focus point of evolution, like the selfish gene, as the Neo-Darwinian call it, is of course focused on a self-sense of a separate identity of a gene that is separate from the whole, and the whole recognition that, wait a moment, cooperation is a big part of it, realizes much more that there's a one whole integrated process going on, and the gene and the genetics are part of it, but they're not necessarily the center of it.
Right. There is this, you know, it's this kind of, you know, classic scientific move to reduce things to a certain type of essence, like the gene. And, of course, the selfish gene is this powerful metaphor. And it's very powerful to think about evolution that way. There's a lot that comes out of that perspective, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And what we're realizing is that, you know, there was this whole picture of evolution as this dog-eat-dog competition, survival of the fittest, social Darwinism, you know, in the 19th and early 20th century. And to some extent, evolutionists today have perpetuated that, that it's just this kind of dog-eat-dog competitive world of everyone struggling to survive and the strongest win, you know. That's not really the picture of evolution that's come out of the latest research, which is this really dynamic picture of a very of these cooperative dynamics in nature, up and down the natural process. We see these cooperative dynamics, whether we're talking about, you know, these kind of socializing dynamics, whether we're talking about molecules and quarks, or whether we're talking about bacteria, or whether we're talking about human beings or animals, you know, up and down you see that, you know, the nature of nature is also cooperative and social. And that as much as we might emphasize the competitive nature of evolution, and we also have to emphasize the cooperative and social nature of how evolution works. And so, you know, there are kind of both sides of the picture, and any kind of full understanding of what evolution is has to keep in mind this dynamic relationship between those two. And so in that chapter in the book, I was really trying to capture that and say, look, you know, even this, even the way we think about Darwinian evolution today, it's not really the most accurate picture of what's going on. There's a lot of new theories and new ideas that are really changing our perception of even scientific evolution, and certainly when we get into more things like cultural evolution.
No, exactly. And wouldn't you say that also the difference in this perspective to focus on the selfish gene versus to focus on the interaction between the gene and cooperation is also related to cultural development? Because, of course, the whole focus on the separate self-sense, even if it's the separate self-sense of a gene, is very much a modernist understanding of reality. And I would guess that what is integrated here is also a lot of numbers of insights from postmodern thinking that the world is also a big part cooperation, but very much not along along with postmodern thinking, this has an evolutionary dimension. This cooperation is not just a cooperation for its own sake, it's a cooperation with a purpose, a cooperation with a direction.
Yeah, I think if you put it in that light, one way of thinking about this, as you said, is, you know, this kind of this sense of the selfish gene competitive world of you know, evolutionary world is sort of a modern and scientific way of looking at it, you know, and then there's this new science, which is kind of saying, look, there's all these, you know, and individuals like Lynn Margulis, who was Carl Sagan's wife, and she was an American scientist, was a pioneer in this way, and other individuals as well. They're saying, look, you know, sociality and social selection and all these other cooperative dynamics are critical, and it's almost more like the postmodern corrective to the earlier science. But to some of those guys, they're almost emphasizing that too much. They're almost saying, look, that's the way nature works. It's all about cooperation, and it's almost this kind of touchy-feely, you know, kind of kind of evolutionary dynamics or natural dynamics, and you're saying, well, no, that's not quite right either. And I think a deeper understanding that incorporates the insights of modernism and incorporates the insights of kind of a postmodern corrective, you know, a more sort of integral or deeply evolutionary perspective is realizing that there's a dynamic tension between the needs of the self in a certain way and the needs of the larger whole, and it's larger, the larger, and there's always that dynamic tension, and then that dynamic tension is in this evolutionary context. So we're moving forward, and we're always negotiating the needs of the kind of an entity versus the needs of the whole on of which that entity is a part of. And there's always this dynamic tension between the self and the whole, between the part and the whole. And that's the beauty of that. That's part of the driver of evolution. It's part of the context of evolution. So I think in a richer understanding, we're kind of integrating the best of modernism, the best of postmodernism, into a deeper understanding of how the two work.
Oh, that's great. Before I go into the next question, I would like to make a short announcement for our listeners, particularly listeners who are not regulars to Radio Enlighten Next. Just to let you know, at the end of this broadcast, towards the end to this broadcast, you will have the chance to ask questions or have your comments for Carter Phipps. And the way you can do that is you either can call into this broadcast, and the phone number would be in the U.S., 001-559-546-1700. I can repeat this again. It's 001-559-546-1700. Or if you're in Europe, you can use also the German number, which would be 0049-234-543-9810. Once again, 0049-234-543-9810. And the access code would be for both countries 925423 and the hash sign. 925432 and the hash sign. I will give you the numbers again at the end. And also, you have the chance to write an email, which will reach us here in the studio. And the email address you can post your questions or your comments would be radio@enlightennext.de. radio@enlightennext.de. So if you are having some questions or some comments, we are very happy to hear you and read from you. And I will tell you the phone numbers again towards the end of this broadcast. Carter, you not just write about cooperation in terms for evolution, you also use the word the sociable cosmos. What should we understand when you say sociable cosmos? Why is this important?
Well, that's a title of one chapter, and I think the point there was that, you know, again, this we have this vision of evolution as being, you know, some people when you talk about evolution, even spiritual people, they get kind of upset with you. They start talking about that. You know, evolution is the essence of what it means to kind of live in a selfish universe, you know. And you have to really explain to them that, no, you know, again, all the latest research is that, you know, right from the start of the Big Bang, all the way through to where we are now, you know, cooperation and our capacity to engage in cooperative relationships with our fellow human beings, or our fellow, you know, whether chimpanzees or our fellow, you know, bacteria or our fellow quarks and molecules and atoms, you know, whatever it is, you know, has been essential to the advance of cosmological evolution, biological evolution, all the way up. So the capacity to engage in dynamic social relationships is a critical part of how we move forward. And you can see that, again, with the challenges we face as a human civilization and the complexity of our global world, where the challenges we face are global challenges, how do we find new avenues for greater cooperation And of course, there's always, you know, and I think we can find some of the lessons of how to do that, and it helps us to see those challenges in light of this kind of the evolutionary challenges we've been facing for 13.7 billion years. It kind of changes the way in which we see the kind of this, our moment in history. It helps us to think about the globe, facing some of these issues on planet Earth right now, and how we cooperate as individuals, as nations, in global concern to meet these challenges. It's a real evolutionary moment.
Of course, when we talk about evolution, we not only talk about movement, we talk about directionality, moving somewhere. And you also just used the word higher. And of course, the word higher kind of implies a certain form of value judgment, a kind of a hierarchy. And
yeah.
You write in your book about the whole discussion that is a typical postmodern discussion, which basically asks the question, what role is the human role in the whole cosmos or in the planet Earth? Do we really have a specific role in this, or are we not just one species amongst others? Is there something specific human that is better than other species? Are we better than chimpanzees? Are we better than bacteria? And you write about it in a very thoughtful way, because you also make the distinction that, of course, the evolutionary thinking was also abused for all kinds of ethnocentric ends. In particular, talking here from Germany, it also can have very horrific outcomes to understand evolution in this way. In that sense, it is important to kind of see that we are one whole moving here. But at the same time, you're also referring to certain conversations where people basically say the bacteria and humans are kind of equals. And I remember myself having similar conversations. There are one discussions I had with, American philosopher who kind of said, in fact, you also could say that the bacteria are just using us and our technology like planes so that they can cross the oceans, which they wouldn't be able. Why you think that we are using them? There's no reason that you can't think they are using us so that they can travel better. So how can we the knot here? What is the real relationship between hierarchy, evolution, directionality, and what's the role of the humans in all of that?
Well, this is such a critical question, and I really spend some time on the book going through, you know, trying to be kind of very thoughtful about this question, because, you know, there's some easy dangers to fall into when you start, relating to this question. And I feel like, you know, again, if you look at a modernist or postmodern world, there tend to be a tendency to fall into one or the other. Obviously, we know that there's evolution is like this powerful technology. It's like this idea that's quite remarkable. It has tremendous capacity in the idea itself. And just like a powerful technology, if it's abused and used by the wrong person, it can be very dangerous. And of course, we saw that in Germany. We've seen that in other places around the world. You know, it's like the idea that my culture is more evolved than yours and I'm more evolved than you can lead to all kinds of mischief, and more than mischief. You know, it can be disastrous. But nevertheless, it's also a very powerful truth about the way the world is. And if we ignore that truth or ignore that idea, then we are not doing ourselves any favors. And I've seen some people kind of jump, they almost like jump to the opposite conclusion. They say, you know, they're afraid to value, what it means to be human because they fear those kinds of things. And so they almost jump to the other radical conclusions and say there's nothing more valuable, humans and bacteria are more or less exactly the same, you know, that the evolution doesn't really favor one or the other. There's nothing higher or better or more evolved about what it means to be human. And of course, if you look at evolution in some very limited ways, you could draw that conclusion. But when you look at evolution in a way that I would suggest that you look at it, I think there's something very important about what it means to be human, not the least of which is the fact that we are able to have this kind of conversation. You know, there are no other species on the planet, or as far as we know in the universe, and there may be, I'm not saying there aren't, but as far as we know, who are able to have conversations like this. And I think that our capacity to think more deeply and potentially, you know, and feel more deeply and experience life in the way we do and all the good and bad that that implies, those capacities are part of nature too. They are part of evolution's gift. And to me, it's through realizing and understanding more deeply the role and the position that evolution has placed us in, is that we are able to appreciate the power and responsibility of our positions as humans on this planet and going forward. And it's through integrating evolution into our view that we can appreciate more profoundly the actual nature of our position and the incredible power that we have and the incredible responsibility that we have. So I often feel that the problem is not that we're anthropocentric or human-centered. The problem often is that our vision of what it means to be anthropocentric, our vision of what it means to be human, is so limited and so insufficient and it lacks all the dimensionality that this rich understanding of evolution provides. And when we have that, then we can more appropriately, you know, understand what it means to be human in a way that will allow us to respond to many issues we have. I mean, there are so many challenges that we face now in terms of how we deal with nature, how we deal with other cultures and civilizations, how we deal with ourselves. You know, and to me, the way to respond to those is to not kind of, you know, not close our eyes to the actual nature of the position that evolution has placed us in, not pretend that we're the same as every other species. That, to me, is a step backward. It's like sticking our heads in the sand. We have to more deeply understand who we are, where we've come from, the position that the natural evolutionary process has placed us in, and in that more deeply respond to the challenges of our time.
So that's right. I think the crucial sentence that you just said is this very simple insight that the conversation that we two are having right now, at least to our knowledge, we are the only species who has this kind of conversation about the evolution of the cosmos, the evolution of the universe, the evolution of culture, nature. Of course, this is just as far as we know, but as far as we know, this is the case. And then, if you just appreciate that, not in taking kind of a role like we would be outside the natural process or outside the process of
exactly.
Nature. We are, even culture is part of something that nature developed. But then you realize, wait a moment, we are in a very specific situation. We are capable of reflecting the whole thing, which also means we are capable of making this whole process self-conscious. And mm-hmm. just appreciating this difference of the human position changes the whole game, doesn't it?
It does. You know, I've seen so many kind of people who are very concerned about nature and the environment. They kind of place humans outside of that, like we aren't part of nature. But I want to point out, you know, you can't embrace nature and deny evolution. You know, evolution is a big part of what nature is doing.
Right.
So the very processes that have left us in the position we're in, with all the good and bad of the human predicament and human possibility, that's part of nature too. That's what nature has created. Nature is not just what we see. You know, nature is not just what we see when we see you know green. You know, it's like nature is also this wonderful and flawed world of the human civilization. That's part of what nature is doing. So it is, to me, it is through understanding more deeply what that trajectory is about that we can more powerfully and adequately respond to our situation, and then hopefully respond to the very real issues we have with the natural world around us in all kinds of ways. But I feel like environmentalists, if they close their eyes to that, and then there's a way in which they're not, because they're only looking at one part of the picture, their solutions will always be limited, and they won't be able to embrace all of what it means to be fully human, and then they won't ignore all of what it means, all of what nature is.
No, that's very true. And also, a big part of of your book, in fact, is towards the fact that evolution is not just what usually is in the focus of the modern thinking about evolution, the natural evolution, the evolution of the outside. What you're referring to, and you're bringing a lot of interesting and fascinating stories and people contemplating all that, that also the inside of the whole process is evolving. And you're referring to our interiority as human beings, our culture, and in the end, you're even going to the spiritual dimension of this. Is this also one of the big differences between a postmodern evolutionary view and a modern evolutionary view, that we realize, wait a moment, it's not out there only what's evolving, it's in there and it's the whole thing?
Yeah, you know, no doubt this is a big shift in the way we think about evolution. And, you know, we usually think about it either as just being Darwinian evolution or evolution is happening in biology and nature. But then we start to, you know, it's like been this process where you start to say, oh, wow, we are also part of this cosmological process of evolution. Wow, that's been going on much longer, and what does that mean? And then suddenly we start to realize that our own culture may be caught up in this process, and then what does that mean? And then we start to realize that, you know, that means that our own minds are caught up in this process, and then we start to suddenly, you know, it's this slow dawning revelation in culture that, oh my God, you know, it's not just the world I'm looking at that's evolving. You know, it's the world, it's the very eyes through which I'm looking that are also part of this evolutionary process. And then what does that mean? How does it, when we, and there's all these new theorists and who are beginning to reflect upon this and beginning to reflect on what the connection is between the evolution of our interior world, the evolution of the psychology and the consciousness of our interior world, the evolution of the way we think and perceive and the way we, the whole interior world of what it means to be human, that is not the same. This is the proposition of the book, at least. That, you know, that is in a process of development. That is also not static. What it means to be human, the whole inner interior world of what it means to be human, is not the same as it was 500 years ago, and not the, and it's changed over the last 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 3,000 years. It is caught up in this evolutionary process, and sometimes we don't think about that. And some people hear this is a radical idea that people who lived often 3,000-4,000 years ago, you know, they thought very differently. Their mentality, their cognitive structure, their perceptions and perspectives were quite different in many ways than what we're. We are the way we're thinking and perceiving and the perspectives we have now. And when you start to integrate this whole interior world of the development of consciousness and how it's reflected in human culture, it's like I was saying earlier, going from two dimensions to four. It's like having a whole depth dimension of what it means, what evolution means. And I think this is where really some of the greatest insights of a new evolutionary world view, way of seeing the world, are really come from, is appreciating and thinking about and integrating this new understanding of the interior of evolution as well.
Right. The title of the conference on the 13th of October in Paris on the Sorbonne is The Evolution of Consciousness, Key to Our Future. And I guess what you just laid out is already the reason why maybe the evolution of consciousness is key to our future, because we realize something that we really are in need of to understand, that we only really can move into the future if we evolve as consciousness and as a culture. Is this the difference of a new, also cultural understanding of evolution?
Well, I think it's, I mean, to me, this is, there is so much that's possible when you start to think about evolution in this way. And, you know, we often think about the evolution of consciousness as meaning it sometimes we think about it as like a spiritual, like the evolution of spiritual states of consciousness in some form, or kind of the evolution of it kind of becomes esoteric. And I think what we mean here by the evolution of consciousness is not something that is really esoteric in a certain way. It's subtle, but it's the evolution, you know, of this interior world, and it's there's certainly a spiritual component of it, but it's more than that. You know, it's like the evolution of the way we think and perceive life, the way we feel life, the way we see. It's like. And when we start investigating that dimension, it's like you have this new lens on which you can look at both the human self, but also human culture. And you start to, and you look back 5,000 years, and you see, oh, all these different ways of how cultures develop. You start to connect them, and you start to appreciate this trajectory of how human culture has developed, and how, you know, we start to look around the world today, and we see the challenges. You know, what's the biggest issues we face? If you look at all the political issues we face around the world, you know, one way to look at them is there problems of development. You know, problems of either lack of development in certain ways, or the challenges of developing. And we can begin through this lens to hopefully begin to identify some of the challenges and blocks to development in a new way, and so we can help. We can have a more profound effect on helping cultures around the world develop in very positive, authentic ways. And of course, there's always dangers to this. As again,
exactly.
We can easily slip back into modernist versions where we're just trying to get, other cultures to be more American or more English or more German or whatever it is, you know, whatever our particular version of it is.
Right.
It's like, this is the way to be. But, and of course, that's always a danger. But the danger is also that we just do nothing. You know, we just allow everyone to be who they are, and we just kind of stand back and appreciate difference and appreciate. And that's often not good enough, you know, because people, obviously, there's tremendous issues and people are suffering as a result of lack of development. And we see that every day all around the world, and people are endangering other people because of the lack of the right kind of healthy development. And so through this new understanding, and of course, you know, we'd have to have long conversations about all the different pieces of it and dimensions of it. But through some of these new insights into consciousness and culture, it gives us new leverage and new opportunities to work with our political systems and our social systems in ways that will hopefully be much more appropriate to meeting the developmental challenges of a globalizing world.
Right. You said this new perspective is not esoteric. But there's something I would think that is very subtle and easy to miss. And I think you were touching on it several times when you were saying it is the lens that we're looking through that is evolving. We are looking through new classes. Because usually it's very easy, particularly when we think about evolution and appreciate evolution, to really appreciate the evolution of nature, society, culture, as something out there. But to appreciate that the very eyes that I'm looking through, my own perspective is moving, to use your words,
mm-hmm.
is in itself quite a subtle concept to really let in, because it's so habitual to basically make this a fixed identity, a fixed thing where I'm looking from. But you say no, a real evolutionary worldview in this sense means something different. It means the very way we are looking is evolving.
Exactly, and that's when you start to get into some of these deeper dimensions of what evolution means. It's both personally transformative, it's culturally transformative, it's spiritually transformative, it's transformative on multiple levels. Because, you know, we're not just dealing with the world out there and some idea about how it works. We're also dealing with the challenge of reframing the very way in which we see the structures of ourselves, you know. But when you start to do that, when you start to kind of question and realize, oh my God, you know, and you break what I call this idea of a solid self, this idea of this unchanging fixed entity that we are as an unchanging fixed self moving through a relatively unchanging fixed world. You know, when you see that, no, I'm this, you know, I'm this kind of, you know, self that is this moving, developing, changing process, creative process, moving through this moving, developing, changing world and interacting with this, that you start to see a much more dynamic relationship between how you relate to yourself and how you relate to the world out there. And the opportunity it opens up is when people liberate themselves even a little bit from this idea of being this kind of fixed and static thing, self, it liberates their sense of what's possible. And when they liberate their idea of human nature and human culture from being this fixed and static thing, it liberates their idea of what's possible in relationship to human nature and human culture. And when you put those things together, then you have this there, instead of this you know, fixed self moving through this unchanging world, you have this dynamic, creative self moving through this world in which there are new possibilities about what is possible and how we can develop, how we can evolve, how we can change. And in a sense, you know, that's an evolutionary. You know, someone who's kind of broken in some way this spell of a solid self and this spell of a solid world, and in that has liberated their own sense of what's possible, their own creative potential to impact this further evolution of themselves and of this world. You know? And that's the real fruit to me of this kind of perspective. And that's where it's personally transformative, it's culturally transformative, and it's ultimately spiritually transformative.
Thanks a lot. That's very true. There are a lot of areas that I haven't even touched, particular about the social, the cultural, the political implications of an evolutionary worldview. People who are more interested in that, I really recommend also to read your book, Evolutionaries. It's available on Amazon worldwide, and it's definitely also a very good read, to say. It's really something that you also enjoy reading. And of course, people in Europe, you can also see and hear Carter when he will speak at the conference in Paris on the 13th. You can go to the website of the conference, which is evolutionscience.com, www.evolutionscience.com. There you see all the details for the conference in Paris. But I also want to give our listeners the chance to talk to Carter and pose some questions. And to do this, I will tell you the phone number again, where you can reach us here in the studio. The phone number in the United States is 001-559-546-1700. In Germany, 0049-234-543-9810, and the access code 925423 and the hash sign 925432 and the hash sign. And of course, you can also write us an email at the email address radio@enlightennext.de, radio@enlightennext.de. And if the lines are open, so if you have a question, we are very happy to hear from you. If there's no question on the phone right now, I will read one of the emails. The email question has arrived here in the studio. There a listener asks, we see the example of groundbreaking thinkers who realized those deeper dimensions of evolution. But as I understand you, you are saying that many of us can, in a way, must become evolutionaries today. What does it take for a person to develop as an evolutionary? What capacities do we need to build? I think that's for you, Cara.
Well, I think that's right. I think we are somewhere in between. You know, in the book, I wanted to both present contemporary evolutionaries and contemporary figures who are really breaking ground with this from completely different perspectives. You know, the book covers science, it covers philosophy, it covers cultural development, and it covers spiritual development, and even theological development. So the book covers a lot of different perspectives, and I feature in almost every chapter, you know, I kind of profile a contemporary individual who's sort of pioneering in that area. But I also go back in history, and I feature some of the great historical figures who really pioneered this development. And I feel like, in some ways, we're in this time in history where this perspective has been sort of building for about 200 years. And we've had this period where we have these great visionaries, you know, Teilhard de Chardin and Henri Bergson and Sri Aurobindo and Jean Gebser. And these were great visionaries of this point of view and of this way of seeing the world. And now we've kind of moved into a period of time where we have many more people who are appreciating this, who are understanding this. And I feel like it's just on the verge of becoming a more and more popular movement. But I really feel to begin to integrate this perspective oneself, the first step is to really deeply consider these ideas. And I know sometimes in our postmodern world, you know, cognizing and thinking gets a little bit kind of pushed aside as being superficial. But when it comes to these ideas, you know, they are important and they're significant. And some of the ideas that are at the heart of an evolutionary worldview will change the way you see the world. They are that powerful. They will not just have an impact on your mind. They will have an impact on your heart, on your soul, on the very structures of your consciousness if you deeply let them in and deeply consider them. So I honestly feel like a big part of the first step in how people approach what it means to be an evolutionary is just to think about and to read about and to consider these ideas, consider what they mean for oneself, for culture, you know, pursue them, think about them. That's a huge part of what it means to begin to embrace, to develop. And I think you can't really develop in this context without doing that very robustly. It doesn't mean this is just an intellectual thing. I don't mean that at all. But I mean one needs to think more deeply and spend some time with these ideas.
Now, that's very interesting, Carter, that you're saying this, because usually when we think how to evolve as human beings, we particularly as postmoderns, more think about how to evolve emotionally with our compassion, also with the depth of our humanity. But what you're saying is just consider these ideas. And I really can appreciate that because, if I may say so, you have to understand evolution. It's something you need your cognition to really see. There's this developmental process of these billions of years, and there's the evolutionary process of our cultures, of our human species, and you need thinking to grasp this. And I really appreciate that you're saying this is an intellectual process, but it will touch your heart. It will touch your humanity to really see that this is going on.
No, it's important. It's like you want to be able to see more deeply into life. And in order to see more deeply, you have to kind of consider these ideas in the way they restructure your thinking and the way you see. And you can't ultimately we want to be able to feel very deeply all of these ideas. We want to be able to, you know, but you can't feel what you can't see. You know, it's like, and so part of this is a cognitive process, you know.
I just wanted to read you another email, but I lost my internet connection on my computer here. And I can get it back here.
I often get, you know, questions about people also, how do we apply this perspective? And I'm, you know, I'm very committed to applying this perspective in all kinds of ways. You know, I'm in part of the numerous projects that are trying to do that. So I do care about that very deeply. But sometimes people, you know, they forget that ideas themselves and new perspectives on reality have power on their own. Sometimes people almost assume that we already basically know everything we need to know, and we just need to get everyone on board. And how do we do that? You know, and one of the messages of the book is there are transformative new ideas out there that will change the way you see the world. Let that be true, because it is true, and we need to appreciate that, and that's exciting. That's exciting in and of itself. And sometimes, you know, sometimes in our postmodern world, we feel like, God, you know, everything we really need to know, we already know, you know, and we just need to kind of get on with it. Well, I hope this book is, you know, convinces people that's not true.
Exactly. Now, I also have back the question that one of the listeners is asking you, and she's writing, "Dear Tom and Carla, the realization that we are evolution seems to change everything. When we take this seriously, we realize in the same moment how much evolution is influenced by how we live our lives. And this puts us a lot of responsibility in our hands and power. What do you think is needed for us to really embrace this responsibility in the best possible way?"
Well, I mean, I think we, you know, we touched on some of this, which is I feel like the more deeply we appreciate the nature of our position as human beings, the more profound will be our response to it. And the more we appreciate, the more we deeply understand where we've come from, the more we understand our past, the more we understand the developmental challenges we faced as human beings over the last thousands of years, the more we understand the nature of the evolution of consciousness and culture over the last thousands of years, the more robust we appreciate that. Because ultimately, evolution informs us about the past, but it doesn't inform us about the past just so we can be good historians. It informs us about the past so that we can embrace the future, because ultimately evolution points us toward the future. It informs us about the past so we can more fully embrace the future, more profoundly respond to the future, more robustly respond to the future. And so I think part of the imperative as evolutionaries is to understand the actual position we're standing in, you know, and to understand that you have to appreciate where we've come from. And the more you appreciate where we come from, the more deeper you get a sense of where we're going, and the more appropriate your responses will be, and the more creative, and the more impactful, and the more powerful will be your responses to where we're going. And that's the ultimate goal, is to get people connected and start to feel like they can contribute more directly to creating the next step in this process of evolution, you know, this process of development, in this case, human evolution. But as we know right now, our evolution is impacting the evolution of every other living being that we know of.
Right.
That's critical.
Absolutely. I think that's really a major point we have to let in, that our evolution as a species, which means our evolution, influences the evolution of all other species and the whole, at least this globe, at least the planet Earth, more than anything else at this point. And if we just let that in, we see how the evolution of consciousness is more and more at the center of the evolution of this globe, because we are so influential on how this whole, at least this Earth, can flourish and can go to the next step here. There's one last question or comment I want to read to you, where a listener writes, "It is really great to listen to your dialogue. I find it fascinating what Carla is describing about the dynamic of competition and cooperation, and how the needs of the individual and the greater whole on have to work together. this seems a very challenging task for us humans to accomplish right now. Do you think that this was always the case, or are we just more aware of it? The way I understood you is that we are now able to see with a lot more perspective and differentiated way the complex of evolving system. But the complexity we are dealing with has always been that way.
I think that's accurate. I think in some respects, I might add that I think in some ways we are becoming, like the listener said, more aware of the complexity of like the evolutionary dynamics of what we're working with. But I think the complexity that we're dealing with is probably, we've always been dealing with these things probably as humans, but mostly unconsciously, which is why evolution has been really messy. And why the development of our civilization has been really really messy over the last 5,000 years. The opportunity is for it to become a little less messy. that would be profound. That would be huge if we could usher in a developmental era for human beings that was a little more forward-looking, a little more positive, a little less messy, a little less unconscious. That would be huge, and we absolutely need that because I think the complexity of the challenges we're facing are actually greater right now. I mean, we have threats to our global world that we've never had before. You know, the power we have in our hands through technology, we've never had before. I mean, our modernist world with its incredible advances has given us these extraordinary challenges. They kind of left them in our lap. and we have to deal with these challenges, and we have to deal with them without regressing, you know, without closing our eyes, you know, and while keeping this sense of possibility and for the future. You know, I traveled around a lot in the last few months, and one of the things I see is that people, there's this kind of pessimism out there, and I find this pessimism quite painful in a way, because I know that there's a part of that pessimism comes from an authentic concern about the human condition and the state of things right now. And I know there's an authentic concern at the heart of it. And I know that there's a whole other range of people that are completely optimistic, but they aren't really concerned about all those things. You know, it's like,
right.
And so there's this kind of dynamic where there's this whole, you know, at least in America, there's this whole class of intellectuals that are really optimistic about the future. And they're pointing out how much things have changed over the last 5,000 years. And they have a critical point. But I'm not sure they're really authentically dealing with a lot of the great challenges we have to face as well. And then there's a bunch of people who are really pessimistic. But I think what often is missing in that pessimism is a deep evolutionary sense of where we've come from and where we're going, and this kind of multidimensional sense of the evolutionary trajectory of our species. So you start to see, oh, I can face these great challenges in the light of this larger, really, you know, this larger potential, this larger evolutionary vision. And then I feel like the pessimism gets sort of wrapped in this context of optimism in a way. It gets wrapped in this context of this sense of possibility about the challenges we face and the challenges we... And then you see, it doesn't make anything any easier. It doesn't make things any simpler. It doesn't mean that there aren't real issues that we have to deal with, because there are. But then you start to see them in the context of this evolutionary trajectory, and that really changes the context in which you meet those authentic, real challenges. There are no guarantees. There are no inevitabilities here. But we can, I think, face all of these issues without losing that fundamental sense that there are extraordinary possibilities here. There are extraordinary, it's an extraordinary evolutionary moment. And that gives you energy, confidence, conviction, optimism, but not naive. You know, it's not an avoidance. It's to deal with the actual issues we deal with. So I feel like the pessimists have a point. The optimists have a point. Somehow we have to bring those two together in this deep evolutionary vision.
Kalle, thank you very much for your insights. We are at the end of our webcast here, and for everyone who wants to hear Carter here in Europe, he will be here in Paris on October the 13th on Lisbon at the conference, The Evolution of Consciousness, Key to Our Future. You find more about this conference at the website www.evolutionconscience.com. And, of course, you can read Carter's book, Evolutionaries, which you can find online on Amazon or on other websites. And I very much recommend this book. It's really, really great read. It introduces a lot of these thinkers that Carter was mentioning. And Carter, thank you very much for your time. And have a good day in San Francisco.
Thanks so much, Tom. I really appreciate doing it. My first German interview.
Fantastic.
Take care.
Take care.